So it's all here. The story of our time with the bar call.
That was President Lyndon Baines Johnson upon the dedication of his presidential library in 1971. Since then, the library has played host to the biggest names and best minds of our day, who have helped to tell the story of our times through candid, revealing conversations with the Bar Call. This podcast delivers them straight to you. Welcome to With the Bar Call. I'm Mark Updegrove.
In her new book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight, and her attendant ABC News podcast, In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson, author Julia Swagg takes a very different look at the former First Lady, relying heavily on rarely heard oral diaries that Mrs. Johnson made throughout her time in the White House. Her portrait shows Mrs. Johnson to be a vital and largely underappreciated force in LBJ's presidency and in American life. In this episode, I talk to Julia about the woman she has come to know through her 6 years of research, the remarkable Lady Bird Johnson.
The cars accelerated terrifically fast, faster and faster. I cast one last look back over my shoulder. Saw a bundle of pink, just like a drift blossom, lying in the back seat. I think it was Mrs. Kennedy lying over the president's body.
Where does this instinct to capture it all even come from, starting now and for the next 5 years? Maybe she has an eye on legacy. Lady Bird had studied history and journalism at the University of Texas and kept small spiral notebooks with her all the time. So as the moment unfolds around her, her instinct is to commit it to record.
They led us to the right, to the left, onward, into a quiet room in the hospital. Suddenly, I found myself face to face with Jackie in a small hall. I don't think I ever saw anybody so much alone in my life.
Julia Swagg, welcome to With the Bar Call. We have just heard the very compelling first moments of your podcast, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight, based on your book, Hiding in Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. This has gotten thunderous attention. What led you to this very important project?
Well, Mark, first, thanks so much for having me. I feel like it's a combination of years of work and a long time of collaboration with you and the library and the foundation, and I'm just thrilled to be here. You know, I wanted to write a book about women and power, simply stated, but I didn't have a topic. And I've lived in Washington for almost 30 years and thought about that topic a lot, lived the experience of watching powerful people make policy and watching the gender balance imbalance continue. And a friend of mine told me, you know, Lady Bird Johnson kept an audio diary the whole time she was in the White House. And that just caught my eye. So I came down to Austin and went to that incredible exhibit in the museum at the library and walked into the room that triggered her narration of that first diary entry. And I was just hooked because Lady Bird's voice is so compelling and her, what Bess Abel once said to me, her social secretary, her ability to paint word pictures. She's an incredibly dynamic observer of detail and of emotion and drama. And that got me started on listening to all of it and reading all of the transcripts and getting into the story of her experience in the Johnson White House years.
You write of Mrs. Johnson in the book's introduction. She was someone whose public persona could feel infuriatingly two-dimensional if one relied on the stiff portrayals in staged White House photographs, rapt biographies, and gendered histories of the Johnson White House. How has she been characterized in the past, and how do you see her differently?
You know, she's been depicted, and I think the images are really important for those of us that didn't grow up, as weren't adults or old enough to absorb the 1960s, as quite two-dimensional and as a very conventional and traditional first lady who stood by her man, the president, and who had literally a stiff upper lip, was tightly controlled, and had a very, very light first lady-like interest in flowers, in beautification. And that felt ornamental. Mm. And I think ornamental is the word that kind of best describes that two-dimensionality that with which she's been depicted.
You talk about these tapes that you rely on for your portrayal of her. Talk about that treasure trove of history. You use the phrase hiding in plain sight both for the podcast and for the book, but in some respects, this is archival material that was hiding in plain sight, and you found it to paint this portrait of a very different Lady Bird Johnson. Talk about those tapes.
Well, the podcast is called In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. The book is called Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. So it's some wordplay, but the concept is that both Lady Bird herself was in front of us, but we didn't see her. And those tapes likewise were sitting at the LBJ library, first in their transcript form, first as a limited collection of that she published in 1970, so a long time ago. And then beginning in 2013, the library began to release the full audio and full unredacted transcripts. She began to record that 8 days after the Kennedy assassination, and she did it straight through the LBJ presidency until January 31st, 1969, when they're back at the ranch. And she writes herself that she did it as a matter of discipline to challenge herself to not let, so that the memory, so that she didn't base her own account of the Johnson presidency on memory, which she understood could be very incomplete. She wanted to have almost a contemporaneous account because she realized she not only had a front seat at history, but that she was a participant in history. And I think that's very important, that goes against that two-dimensional caricature. She knew she was a participant and she wanted us to know it too. But she developed a methodology wherein her staff would gather together for every day. And these I didn't see in their raw form at the library, but a big manila envelope stuffed with his daily diary, her daily diary, news clips of the day, other ephemera that she would sit and from that raw material, and this is where she's kind of amazing as a journalist and historian, she would dictate her draft from the synthesis of pulling together all of that material and come up with these really cohesive, often elegant, sometimes not so interesting, often very interesting accounts of her experience in the White House. First draft, that's what we're hearing.
So in some ways it's a means of documenting history that she's a part of, as you suggest. In some ways, Julia, is it catharsis for her? She is first lady to a very demanding, very powerful man during extremely turbulent times. So can you hear in these things catharsis for her? Is she trying to work through some of the things that she's experienced on a day-to-day basis?
No, Mark, that's a great question. She even wrote about it. I mean, in 1970, when she published the first collection, she said, I did it as a kind of therapy, or it started as a kind of therapy, but then it came a discipline. And I think she needed her alone time. This was a woman who treasured the ability to shut the door behind her and have her space so that she could digest what she was experiencing and not have the constant demands of Lyndon interrupt her and the constant demands on her time of the White House interrupt her. So I think it was a kind of catharsis. And if people who are writers might understand that the solitude that comes from that also helped her to digest and process what she was going through and what the country was going through and Lyndon was going through. And as you say, some of the most challenging, turbulent times in American history. I mean, she describes three political assassinations, mm-hmm. JFK, MLK, RFK, she describes the turbulence of the anti-war movement and the experience and the difficulty she had getting her head around the riots, the political uprisings in American cities at home. So I think you're right. It was catharsis for sure.
I've been around the LBJ orbit now for almost a dozen years. And I've met literally hundreds of people who knew Lady Bird Johnson. I did not have that honor. I just missed when I became the director of the LBJ Library, knowing her because she had died a couple of years before. But never have I heard an ill word about Lady Bird Johnson. Not one single negative thing has anyone said about her. What makes her so extraordinary?
When I started writing this project, doing this project, to your point, one of those people who knew her very well said to me, "You're going to have a hard time not producing a hagiography," meaning no one has a negative word to say about this woman. How are you going to do this justice? You know, she was very comfortable in her skin. And this, of course, I didn't meet her either. I'm basing this on my own research and my interviews and listening to her for as long as I have and reading as much as I possibly could and taking it all in. Very comfortable in her own skin and genuinely interested in you, in what you have to say and offer. I mean, she must have been the person who invented the concept of leading from behind, which is associated with President Obama. But I think she in her bones understood that power is the ability to get other people to believe that what they're doing for you is actually in their interests. Now, that's a kind of Machiavellian way of stating it. She was a person, though, who, aside from that idea of power, really did have the ability to make others around her feel at ease. Mm. Plus, she was so lovely and interesting. And I think people must have just been dazzled by her equanimity, which she seemed to have in droves. But also, you know, it's true that there is this polarity that we talk of between LBJ and his emotional roller coaster and Lady Bird and equanimity. But one of the things that you see in the diaries is how open she is about her own emotions. Mm. That woman who's supposedly so two-dimensional writes about her own emotional swings, her depression, clouds of inertia and stasis that surround her, and I think they balance one another, Lyndon and Lady Bird, that she'll wake up feeling just paralyzed for no reason, emotionally drained, and Lyndon gives her the boost of energy that she needs. Mm-hmm. Lyndon's ability to recover from his own depressions, and of course this goes to the dynamic in the marriage and between them, right? She fed him, but he also fed her. Mm-hmm. So when she says, "You can't understand one of us without understanding the other, our lives were totally intertwined," I think that's one thing that she's talking about.
But you never see, despite the emotion that she's clearly feeling,
yes,
the emotional upheavals we know Johnson to have, LBJ to have had, you don't see it. So where does Lady Bird Johnson exercise those emotional demons? Where do you see her letting out all that emotion, which clearly has to be pent up in her? Because what we see, the public Lady Bird Johnson is so reserved, is so disciplined. And she is showing you exactly who she wants you to see, but not necessarily the person that's inside. Where is that person?
Well, so that's a great point. She shows you who she wants you to see, but those diaries tell you a little bit more. And one of the answers to the question is exercise. You know, Lady Bird Johnson as a kid grew up going to that spa, the Kellogg Spa in northern Indiana, where Kellogg had his spa, right? So she's kind of a health and fitness person from the time she's a teenager. By the time they're at the White House, she's a disciplined swimmer, and she writes often about needing to swim those 30 or 40 laps. or she doesn't in the LBJ Lake outside of the ranch. She's a swimmer, and she writes frequently about how much she needs to exercise her body. And she also writes about what happens to her when she doesn't. That's one answer. I mean, in a lighter way, she also uses the bowling alley at the White House all the time. And she writes about it as her way of letting off steam.
I want to play two. You mentioned the tapes as being these archival gems from the LBJ Library, these diaries, these oral diaries that Lady Bird Johnson kept. But the other crown jewels of the LBJ Presidential Library archives are the taped telephone conversations of LBJ doing the business of his presidency. And there are two I want to share, Julia, that I think give us a glimpse into the relationship between these two extraordinary people. The first one comes from a press conference that LBJ does on March 4th, 1964, just a couple of months or several months into his presidency. And it's he calls Lady Bird Johnson for her critique. We'll listen to this tape, and I'd love to hear your comments about it.
You want to listen for about 1 minute to my critique, or would you rather wait till
yes,
tonight?
Yes, ma'am. I'm willing now.
I thought that you looked strong, firm, and like a reliable guy. Your looks were splendid. The close-ups were much better than the distance ones.
Well, you can't get them to do it.
Well, I would say this. There were more close-ups than there were distance ones. During the statement, you were a little breathless, and there was too much looking down, and I think it was a little too fast. Not enough change of pace. Drop in voice at the end of sentence. There was a considerable pickup in drama and interest when the questioning began. Your voice was noticeably better, and your facial expression was noticeably better. In general, I'd say it was a good B+. How do you feel about it?
I thought it was much better than last week.
So, Julia, what does this conversation say about the relationship between Lyndon and Lady Bird Johnson?
A few things, Mark. Number one, it says that Lyndon relied on Lady Bird, cared what she thought, sought her advice and judgment. These are the early months of the transition after the JFK assassination, and LBJ is very concerned about his ability to keep the country unified. So his public persona and the narrative the two of them are trying to put out is of top priority for him. And so he's consulting with Lady Bird all the time, and this is just one element of it, about how he's coming off in public. By the way, she also was very concerned about her own persona, and the two of them were aware that even though they had a media company, they didn't necessarily come off well publicly on the radio and in television. So they were constantly trying to improve themselves and checking in with one another about how they were doing.
So this was done in early March of 1964. They had been in the presidency for just over 3 months at that point. And as you suggested, they're checking each other because they're in these roles that they did not prepare for. In fact, you quote Lady Bird Johnson, both in the book and the podcast, as saying she's playing a role that she had never rehearsed for. You know, she's new to this role. What is that transition like for Lady Bird Johnson, going from the second lady of the United States, who very few people knew, to becoming the first lady upon the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy?
Well, I don't know if she would say this, but possibly it was the most difficult thing she ever had to do in her life. The assassination itself, of course, is incredibly traumatic. And the transition that she and Jackie together orchestrate over the 14 days between the assassination and when they move in the White House is done totally in public. The country is traumatized. And as you say, and she said, she really wasn't prepared for it. Now, this gets into the question of Lady Bird and Lyndon's plans for his own political career and at what point he would have the opportunity himself to run for the presidency. But this was way premature. And they understood very readily that they had to keep the country unified and have a narrative wherein those two, Lyndon especially, could do it. And of course, this was in the spring of 64 when he's getting ready to try to, between the tax legislation that had been stuck in Congress under JFK and civil rights legislation that had also barely moved. Those were going to be the two signature legislative accomplishments of 1964. And Lady Bird was totally behind Lyndon and watching him closely, because as difficult as it was for Lady Bird, it was high stakes for Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
The highest of possible stakes. So she had to be there for herself and for him. And I think it was just hugely challenging. Then, of course, there's the relationship with Jackie Kennedy, who has in the public's eye this stature of romance and fashion and gorgeousness. And, you know, it's the caricature of the South and corn pone versus Camelot and that elite culture that Jackie embodies. And in a way that frees Lady Bird, because she knows that there's no possibility that she can step in Jackie's shoes, that she has the opportunity as First Lady to really create something for herself.
Mm-hmm.
That just, you know, it's a little bit different, right? Lyndon grabs onto these two aspects of JFK's legislative agenda. Lady Bird says, no, I got to pivot. And she does. And that frees her. And that allows her to develop over the course of the next few years. It's called beautification, but of course it's a deep environmental vision that she's trying to enact in the country.
So I hear that the difficulty in succeeding Jackie Kennedy, who is the epitome of grace and style and a very sympathetic figure after her husband is assassinated, and she wears that so gracefully on the public stage. But talk about the relationship between Lady Bird Johnson and Jackie Kennedy. How do they interact during this transition that Lady Bird Johnson and Jackie Kennedy are going through after the assassination of John Kennedy?
Well, it goes back to the 1950s when they're both Senate spouses, and Jackson the Senate and LBJ is majority leader, which gives Lady Bird this kind of, you know, queen of the roost status herself. If you're the wife of the majority leader in Senate spouse politics of the 1950s, Lady Bird was Jackie's senior, and Lady Bird brought Jackie into the fray. Jackie wasn't that into it, but that was the relationship. It was a hierarchy where the Johnsons were above the Kennedys, if you will. But when LBJ decides to join the JFK ticket in 1960, and that's a very difficult moment for both Johnsons, the relationship begins to shift. And at first, Lady Bird campaigns for Jack and campaigns as Jackie's surrogate in the 1960 campaign. And when Lady Bird is second lady, takes on all kinds of tasks, all kinds of ceremonial and public appearances for Jackie. So by the time, because Jackie doesn't have the kind of interest or stamina, isn't the kind of political animal that Lady Bird is. You know, Lady Bird's been in Washington for 30 years. This is the coin of her realm. She's comfortable with it, and she's very happy on the rope line, not Jackie. So when the assassination thrusts them into this excruciating moment of having to orchestrate a transition out of the White House for Jackie into the and her kids and into the White House for the Johnsons, there, I think the two of them perform with incredible grace and care. Mm. And there's this scene that Lady Bird narrates. It's November 26, 1963. And that's, do the math, 4 days after the assassination. Lady Bird goes to the White House. Jackie receives her. Lady Bird says, oh, we're going to just talk about the everyday matters that two people switching houses would talk about. But of course, it was a lot more than that. And they go through the family quarters. Lady Bird tells us that they see Caroline and John John's bedrooms and talk about which bedrooms Linda and Lucy should take. And then they walk into the yellow room, and they go from the frivolity of kids' bedrooms. It's not just frivolity, it's heavy. But they walk into the yellow room, and there are the boots of the riderless horse that have just been in the funeral procession over the weekend. So the
day before this happened?
The day before. So the power of the moment and the fact that the two get through it, they get through it and they coordinate and they manage. It's just astonishing. But after Jackie leaves, she withdraws from Washington and she withdraws from the Johnsons. And she gives a couple of interviews in 1964 to Arthur Schlesinger Jr., where she's very derisive of Lady Bird. She describes her as Lyndon's trained hunting dog because she kind of doesn't understand that Lady Bird Johnson is a member of Lyndon's administration, was during the campaign a full member of his team. She doesn't really see that. And so she poo-poos Lady Bird a little bit, and the distance between them continues. You really hear it and see it, at least in Lady Bird's account, of seeing one another at St. Patrick's Cathedral at the funeral for Bobby Kennedy in June of 1968. The last thing I'll note, though, is that afterwards, now we're talking the 1980s, they find one another again. And they see one another every summer for several years in the 1980s in Martha's Vineyard. And they manage to spend a day together. In fact, with Harry Middleton, the founding director of the LBJ Library, Harry and Lady Bird go to Martha's Vineyard every summer, and she reconnects with Jackie and attends Jackie's funeral when she dies.
Julia, I'm going to play a second tape now, also from 1964, albeit the fall of that year. And this relates to an indispensable aide to Lyndon Johnson, who had been with him since his days in the Senate, named Walter Jenkins. Walter Jenkins was caught up in a scandal just before the fall of the presidential election in 1964, which pits Lyndon Johnson against Barry Goldwater, his Republican challenger. Walter Jenkins has been picked up by the police for having a homosexual encounter in a YMCA in Washington. Walter Jenkins, the Catholic husband and father of six children. I'll play this, and then I'd love to hear your response to it.
I would like to do two things about Walter. I would like to offer him the number two job at KTBC. Do you hear me?
KTBC is the Johnsons' television station in Austin. LBJ, not on board.
I wouldn't do anything along that line now.
But Lady Bird knows they're not going to be able to hide from this thing.
I don't think that's right. When questioned, and I will be questioned, I'm going to say that this is incredible for a man that I've known all these years, a devout Catholic, the father of six children, a happily married husband. It can only be a small nervous breakdown.
LBJ would rather stick to his lawyer Abe Fortas's plan.
I wouldn't say anything because it's not something you get involved in now. Whatever you do, don't do anything right. Talk to Clark and Abe.
Lady Bird has actually gotten ahead of that.
All right, Abe approves of the job offer. Abe approves of the statement.
What?
She's already called both of them.
Abe approves of the job offer. Abe approves of such a statement when questioned.
Well, talk to Clark.
I must say that Clark does not approve of the latter.
Neither does the president.
Oh, I don't see any reason to know publicly, because then you confirm it, you approve that you're part of it, everything else. You just can't do that to the presidency, honey. I don't think you realize the First Lady can't be doing it.
So, Julia, set the scene for us. To talk more about what's happening here and what it reveals about the relationship between these two people.
So this recording takes place on October 14th, 1964. So in a way, it's the October surprise of the 1964 election. Lady Bird has just been campaigning in the South on her Whistle Stop tour, and the arrest takes place while she's in the South. She comes back to Washington. Liz Carpenter, her chief of staff and press strategist, gets this call and learns about what's just happened. Lyndon is up in New York campaigning as well. So that's the context. And what we hear is, I think, extraordinarily important, because you know, we hear so much about the Johnson treatment. That's Lyndon Johnson being able to strong arm with charm and pressure and manipulation and the awareness of the other's weaknesses and what the other wants to get his way. And I hear Lady Bird as a master of the Johnson treatment in this call, moving Lyndon toward an outcome that she wants, but really having done her homework first. You know, when he says to her, well, call Clark and Abe, and she says, I've already done that. That's pretty extraordinary, because what you don't hear, I mean, he does say you can't address this the way you want to. You can't do the humane thing that you're proposing. We have to just go old school politics and bury this. But he doesn't say to her, hang on a second, what are you doing? This is my presidency. That's not your role. What I take away from that is he fully expects her to be the thinking political strategist that she is. He's not surprised by that. He's just not ready for her proposal, but he comes around to it. And in fact, with a slight wrinkle after she puts out her statement, which is one of recognizing Walter's humanity, a statement which winds up pretty much neutralizing the problem, the Oval Office, the West Wing, puts out a very similar statement as Lady Bird does. And the wrinkle is they also announced an FBI investigation, which of course is about, you know, it's the 1960s, but it feels like the 1950s. It's about, you know, J. Edgar Hoover in the 1950s and kind of McCarthyite homophobia all wrapped into one, and the political angst that a 1964 electoral campaign by a Democrat can have when you've got Barry Goldwater challenging you on so many fronts. And they took that Goldwater challenge seriously. And fortunately, Goldwater and Jenkins knew one another. So I think one aspect was Goldwater was not inclined, because he had a personal relationship with Jenkins, to go as low as Abe and Clark Clifford thought he may.
Is there one story you've come across, Julia, that reflects the Lady Bird Johnson that you have come to know most effectively, most resonantly?
Yes, it's a story that I put together, Mark, in trying to understand what was really behind the phrase beautification. And it has to do with Lady Bird Johnson's environmentalism and the ambitious vision she had on that front. In 1966, and now we've had over a year of riots in American cities, she goes out to San Francisco and she's told there about a landscape architect named Lawrence Halprin, who is a New Yorker. He's kind of a hippie from Marin County. His mother was a leading Zionist activist when he was growing up in New York. Couldn't be more different from Lady Bird Johnson. But she goes to Ghirardelli Square, which he had been involved in designing and developing. And she sees that in Halprin, because of his vision of taking an old rundown part of the city and renovating it totally and saving it, that Halprin might be an incredible partner for what she wants to do in Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., which is a city that it's a federal city with not even a mayor or a city council at that time, she brings Halprin back to Washington, D.C., and the two of them together, with a cast of other characters, but really the two of them together, including Secretary of Interior Stu Udall and the person who will become the first appointed mayor of Washington, D.C., Walter Washington, they start to think about how to bring together civil rights and environmentalism. And they do it in Southeast and Southwest Washington, D.C., along the Anacostia River. She doesn't have a budget. The East Wing doesn't have a budget at that time. But she raises money to pay for Halprin to develop what he calls a master plan for the nation's capital. And it's not for tourist Washington. It's not for the tulips and the cherry trees and the azaleas that are part of her great project for Washington. It's for the most underserved neighborhoods in D.C., where the National Park Service has all of this gorgeous undeveloped land that's completely segregated still, where there's no recreation, where the American citizens that do live there have no services, no food deserts is what we would call it today. And Halperin develops, with Lady Bird's political support, this incredible vision for the Anacostia River to desegregate access and bring the local residents, who are primarily Black and brown and poor, access to parks, which she believes, going back to our discussion about nature, that in American cities, we all have to have access to nature in order to feel whole, full stop. So that, I think that vision and that belief that America, that it's not just highways and monuments that need that beautification, it's the most underserved Americans in the most unrepresented part of this country, Washington, D.C., who could benefit from that marrying together of civil rights and environmental justice. And that is a story that is completely unknown and that says a lot to me about her vision and her ambition.
Another story that's little known about Lady Bird Johnson, you said she is often associated with beautification, through which there's a lot of ambiguity, because it's far deeper, as you suggest, than most people realize. It's really ultimately about environmentalism. But her contributions to civil rights are not recognized as much as they might be. Talk about what she does in the fall of 1964 to help the cause of civil rights.
So the Civil Rights Act passes in July of 1964. They go from that to the August 1964 convention. And from between August and November is high campaign time for both Johnsons. And Lady Bird understands, having grown up with family in Alabama, the depth of the potential white backlash against civil rights in the South. Lyndon understands it too, of course. But she decides that she doesn't want LBJ to lose the South by default. That's her phrase. And so she and Liz Carpenter and Lindy Boggs organize a whistle stop tour. It's the first time a First Lady of the United States ever campaigns in a presidential election without her husband. And she goes on 47 stops through 8 states over 4 days, campaigning as she goes south through ever more difficult crowds, where at first the response is not too threatening, but by the time she gets to the border between Alabama and Florida, there the backlash by the white supremacists who are infiltrating the crowds and issuing death threats becomes very, very palpable. But her message is to embrace what she calls the New South, to say, we're with you, we're not rejecting you, but you ought to understand that our future, that is our future as a country and as the South, is one in which racial justice prevails. Not her language, she does it very carefully, but she's trying to bring her people along. And it's very, very bold, and it's very, very serious for her. She takes it very seriously, and that is a position that she comes into the White House believing in and leaves the White House believing in.
What do you think Lady Bird Johnson's most significant contribution to American life is?
I think without Lady Bird Johnson, Lyndon Johnson's presidency, both its great triumphs and its tragedies, especially Vietnam, would full stop not have been possible. She was a full partner in his presidency, and I think we have to understand that from civil rights to the Great Society to his very significant environmental legacy, Lady Bird Johnson is part and parcel of that. She's the most important member, arguably, of the Johnson administration, especially once they lose Walter Jenkins. She becomes the anchor and the go-to advisor for Lyndon Johnson across the board. Now, I mentioned the positives, but we should also talk about Vietnam briefly, at least, because there I think she had the blinders that LBJ did. She had, in the early 1964, as LBJ did, a lot of fear about how to avoid escalating the war. And once he decided he couldn't resist the pressure to escalate, she was all in. And that really, and she really didn't start to allow herself to see what a mistake that was, from what I can tell, until about the fall of 1967, when the dissent on American campuses and on American streets, and the possibility that her two daughters, fiancés and spouses, were going to go to Vietnam, begins to shift the way she thinks about the war and the way she thinks about its damage to the LBJ presidency.
You start this book with a memo that essentially charts the trajectory and duration of Lyndon Johnson's presidency. It's extraordinary in hindsight. And in fact, I'm in back of me are both of the memoirs of Lyndon and Lady Bird Johnson. And both of these books talk about this memo, but you talk about it in much more significant terms as being almost a pillar of the Lyndon Johnson presidency. Talk about that memo and what it portends for Lyndon Johnson.
So in May of 1964, now they've only been in the White House for 4 months, civil rights is stuck in the Congress and the pressure on Vietnam is very, very palpable. Lady Bird is out in Middleburg, Virginia, because she's gotten some bad press about her tenants in Alabama. The place where she is, and the memo I've called the Huntland strategy memo is called Huntland. And Lyndon is completely racked by doubt at this moment about whether he should run in 1964, 6 months out from the election. And he asks her if she would lay out her analysis in pros and cons about whether he should run or not, upside and downside. And she writes this, what I call a memo. In the LBJ library, it's called a letter. But I think that's sort of a feminized way of describing what this really is, which is a strategy memo. So the National Archives hasn't approved of my renaming this document, but for a purpose of elevating it to the significance I think it has, I've called it the Huntland strategy memo. And it's written out in her handwriting on a stenographic notebook. And she says, look, you should run. She lays out the cons of not running. She even writes out a press statement that he can release, which says, I'm not the guy to run. Thank you very much, in essence. So she provides that draft and she does that draft so that he can feel what it's like to announce publicly that he's not going to run. And she basically says, this isn't going to sit well with you. You're not ready to retire. It would be a very big mistake for you personally and politically. And in fact, if you run in the fall, you'll probably win. And we'll have to deal with a lot of pressure and a lot of negative press, and Vietnam will cause great pain. But if you run and you will win, you can announce in February or March of 1968 that you're not going to stand for another term. And of course, at the end of March 1968, March 31st, Lyndon announces to the country that he will not run for another term. And there are only maybe three or four people at that time who really understood that this goes back to 1964. Maybe only two people, because of course by then Jenkins is gone or he's back in Texas. So I see this memo and the fact that Lyndon published it in full in his memoir, and Lady Bird less so, but she's got it in there, as setting the arc and the trajectory of the presidency in terms of its chronology. We understand subsequently, or the conventional wisdom has been, that it's Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy and the Vietnam War that forced his hand, that no president would step away from power, right? This is kind of a crazy thought. But Lyndon and Lady Bird had been planning it all along, and it's not just that memo. If you track it against all of her diary entries, Mark, what you see is that starting in the fall of 1967, kind of as the problem of Vietnam is sinking in, but even before that, she starts going after him. Okay, when are we going to have this? How are we going to do it? Will you make the statement in the fall of 67 or at the State of the Union in January of 68? John Connolly, the governor of Texas, is involved in the planning. Eventually, Lady Bird and one other staff person and LBJ are the only ones who are writing the statement. And it's a complete and total surprise until he announces it to almost everybody, but not to them because they've been planning it for 4 years.
The book is Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. The podcast is In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. The author and podcast host is Julia Swag. Julia, thank you so much for being with us.
Mark, I loved being here with you today. Thanks so much for having me.
My thanks to Julia Swag, to our sponsors, the Moody Foundation and St. David's Healthcare, and as always, to you for joining us.
If you've enjoyed this episode, subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Mark Updegrove. See you next time.